top stories, Iran blacklists 51 more American individuals over the assassination of its top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's foreign minister says a good agreement is reachable in the Vienna talks if the Western side shows necessary goodwill and determination. The Syrian army intercepts a U.S. military convoy in the Hasaka countryside and forces it to retreat. Welcome to the program. Tehran has updated the list of American individuals blacklisted for involvement in the assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and his companions. Iran's foreign ministry announced it has added 51 U.S. nationals, or officials that is, to the list. It said that Washington acted in glorification of terrorism and violation of the fundamental human rights by conducting, quote, the callous terrorist act. The ministry vowed that the heinous terrorist act will not diminish the resolute determination Iran has in following the path of General Soleimani in fighting terror. On January the 3rd, 2020, the U.S. assassinated Soleimani and his companions, including senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a drone strike at Baghdad airport. Political commentator David Yagubian says the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani was a gross violation of international law.
This was a unilateral, unprovoked attack that constituted a war crime and a gross violation of the United Nations Charter. And this isn't just me and other guests on saying this. This is from Agnes Callamard, who is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings, who in her report was clear about the sheer illegality of this heinous attack. And so, therefore, it's clear justice must be served. And certainly it was important to put the upper crust of the U.S. leadership that was responsible for this heinous attack on notice that justice is going to be served. That would be individuals such as Donald Trump and Bolton and Pompeo. But as we know, the U.S. deep state is quite large, and there are many individuals, as this list of 51 now expanded attests to, who are directly responsible for either the planning of the attack, the organization of the attack, the financing of the attack, and ultimately carrying out the attack. So this list of 51 is a reflection of the, list of those who will need to be called to court or to face justice in some form for the assassination of General Soleimani, Mohandas, and their colleagues.
Iran's foreign minister says reaching a good agreement is possible in the JCPOA revival talks in Vienna if the Western side shows necessary goodwill and determination. Hossein Amir Abdollahian noted that Iran has the necessary determination to achieve a good agreement through goodwill. He made the remarks during a phone call with his Indian counterpart. Meanwhile, Iran's top negotiator in the talks says participants in the ongoing talks are heading forward and making progress. Ali Bagheri Kani says differences among the parties are narrowing. This comes as the other sides have also voiced optimism about the pace of the negotiations. Earlier, we were joined by our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lezgi, who gave us the latest about the Iran P4 plus one talks in Vienna. Take a listen.
We just had a tweet from the Russian ambassador, Mikhail Olyanov, the main source of the news, mostly from these talks on Twitter. And he said that at the end of today, there's been another, in his words, traditional meeting between the 4+1, the remaining signatories of the JCPOA minus Iran and the U.S. delegation, during which, in the words of Mr. Olyanov, the difficult issue of guarantees of a non-repetition of recent problems, he says, was discussed. And he said that the Russian delegation had presented a number of suggestions in this regard. We know, of course, that the issue of guarantees and verification when it comes to the U.S. sanctions removal is of key importance for the Iranian delegation led by Mr. Barghari Khani. Now, going back to the two important issues of guarantees and verification, what Iran has asked for since the beginning of these negotiations, basically, to restore the JCPOA, has been that it wants enough guarantees to be able to get an assurance that the U.S. Will not withdraw from the JCPOA again without Iran being able to benefit from the deal effectively. So it says that it will only go back to its commitments after the verified and effective removal of U.S. sanctions. It wants guarantees that the U.S. will not impose any additional sanctions once the deal is restored that would violate the JCPOA or that would impede its implementation.
January the 8th marks the second anniversary of an Iranian missile attack on an Iraqi airbase hosting American forces. The attack on Ain al-Assad in western Iraq was in retaliation for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian general Qasem Soleimani near Baghdad 5 days earlier. Iran says its attack was just a warning and the ultimate revenge would be the U.S. expulsion from West Asia.
On the 8th of January 2020, Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched a barrage of missiles at Ain al-Assad Air Base, which housed American troops in Iraq's Anbar province. The attack, codenamed Operation Martyr Soleimani, was in retaliation for the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. He, along with senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, were martyred near Baghdad International Airport on the 3rd of January 2020 in a drone strike authorized by former U.S. President Donald Trump. All of the Iranian missiles hit their designated targets as American forces failed to intercept any, despite a high level of readiness in their bases across the region in the wake of Iran's pledge to avenge the assassination. In the meantime, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, stressed that the attack on Ain al-Assad was just a warning. Trump sought to portray the missile strike as a minor incident. Shortly after the Iranian attack, he tweeted, "All is well." Later, in a press conference at the White House, he tried to play down the magnitude of the attack.
No Americans were harmed. Last night's attack by the Iranian regime. We suffered no casualties. All of our soldiers are safe, and only minimal damage was sustained at our military bases.
Controversially, media reports along with satellite images showed that the damage done to Ain al-Assad airbase was much greater than what U.S. officials had acknowledged. There were also conflicting reports on the number of those wounded. Despite initially claiming that the strike resulted in no casualties, the Trump administration ultimately announced that over 100 U.S. forces suffered traumatic brain injuries. The U.S. assassination of anti-terror icons General Soleimani and al-Muhandis raised popular calls in Iraq for the expulsion of American forces from the country. A few days after the assassination, the Iraqi parliament voted for the U.S. withdrawal. Amid the growing calls, the U.S. in December 2021 ended its combat mission in Iraq and limited it to an advisory role. Iran has time and again said the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq and other parts of West Asia is the ultimate price Washington would pay for assassinating General Soleimani, who played a key role in defeating the Daesh terror group in the region.
The Syrian army intercepts a U.S. military convoy in the Hasaka countryside in the country's northeastern corner, forcing them to retreat. According to Syrian media, the convoy of four armored vehicles was driven out of a village north of the town of Talatamar. The U.S. military has stationed troops and equipment in the eastern and northeast part of Syria. The Pentagon claims that the deployment is aimed at preventing the oil fields in the area from falling into the hands of Daesh terrorists. Damascus, however, says the unlawful deployment violates Syria's sovereignty, is meant to plunder its resources. Kazakhstan's President Kasym-Jomart Tokayev holds an emergency meeting to assess the situation that spiraled out of control over a recent fuel price hike. Security is tight around the presidential palace in the capital, Nur-Sultan. Earlier, the National Security Committee announced the arrest of its former chief, Karim Masimov, and several other officials on suspicion of treason. Masimov was sacked after protesters in the city of Almaty stormed government buildings earlier this week. Days of unrest have left 44 people, including law enforcers, dead. Israel's foreign ministry reports the death of an Israeli in Almaty. Meanwhile, the Russian president held a phone call with his Kazakh counterpart. Tokayev told Vladimir Putin that the situation in his country is stabilizing. Moscow slams the latest comments by U.S. Secretary of State that Kazakhstan might have a hard time getting the Russian forces it invited to the country to leave. The Russian Foreign Ministry called Blinken's remarks offensive and boorish. It said Washington should analyze its own track record of interventions in countries such as Vietnam and Iraq. The Russian Foreign Ministry added, "When Americans are in your house, it can be difficult to stay alive and not be robbed or raped." It also argued the deployment in Kazakhstan was a legitimate response to the Kazakh government's request for support from the Collective Security Treaty Organization, which is an alliance led by Russia. On Friday, Blinken said, "One lesson of recent history is that once Russians are in your house, it's very difficult to give them or get them to leave, actually." Political commentator Mr. William Jones says Washington's remarks on the presence of Russian peacekeepers in Kazakhstan are not only uncalled for, but also counterproductive. Take a listen, please.
The situation in Kazakhstan is becoming very serious. It was happened very quickly, and obviously there were a lot of other forces who were engaged in that from abroad who were manipulating this situation as far as we can see, although only time will tell, and the captured some of the people who were arrested probably through interrogation will find more about that. But it was a destabilization of the country, and the president, Tokayev, did appeal to the security organization, the CSTO, of which it is a part, to come and help. So there were a lot of problems there, and those were measures that were set up in order to deal with possible problems from this front. So there's all legitimate move for the Russians and the Kyrgyz and the Tajiks. All of these are sending people into Kazakhstan as a part of the CSTO mission, so that the remarks of Blinken were not only uncalled for, but they were really counterproductive, because I think this really is an attempt to undermine, the real attempt to get control over the situation. And although the United States might not have been responsible for perpetrating this, it's certainly doubtful, but not totally impossible, given their own track record. This plays into the continued destabilization.
European countries report a fresh surge in COVID cases and deaths amid the spread of the Omicron variant. Britain says its death toll has surpassed the 150,000 milestone. It is the worst hit country in Europe by the coronavirus. British authorities also register 146,000 daily cases. Italy reported another jump in daily infections with over 197,000 cases. The government has made mask wearing mandatory outdoors. It's blamed, or it's actually also banned concerts and open air events. Russia reported over 16,000 new cases. The latest wave of the coronavirus is related to the highly transmissible Omicron variant, first detected in South Africa in November of last year. Jerome Hughes says there is a great deal of concern regarding the COVID situation in the European Union amid an Omicron-driven surge in infections.
Again, we use the word a lot, but there's a great deal of concern here at the European Union. And what the experts are saying is that they anticipate just like we saw in the middle of January 2021, that in about a week's time, we're going to see a surge. We're going to see the results of large gatherings, people coming together during the holiday period. We saw it 12 months ago, and that's what they're predicting now in 7 days' time. So, you know, the true number of cases, actually, I mean, you talk about in Italy almost 200,000 new cases in a 24-hour period, and more than 150,000 in Spain. But the true number of cases, of course, is expected to be much, much higher, because different countries in the EU, the 27 countries, they have different capacities in terms of testing. So in terms of people having symptoms and trying to get a PCR test, in some countries it's relatively easy, in some countries it's very difficult. And also the availability of rapid antigen tests are also, that varies greatly across the EU as well, depending on the situation of the pandemic and how it's affecting the population. So, you know, the problem is, of course, Omicron is less deadly, but when you have, you know, the population here, 430 million people, you have almost 150 million adults who have not been vaccinated. But even, you know, with Omicron being less deadly, the more and more people it affects, even a small percentage of a huge number of people means that invariably that hospitals are going to be put under pressure.
Iran has reported 700 new coronavirus infections, the lowest number of daily cases in almost 2 years. Some 6 million people have contracted the virus here. 24 people died of COVID in the past day, unfortunately. And that brings the overall death toll to around 131,000 here. Iran set another record low on Friday, reporting only 19 fatalities, the lowest daily toll also in 2 years. COVID-related figures have been declining in Iran thanks to the country's mass vaccination campaign. Over 122 million jabs have been administered. Well, that includes more than 60 million people who've received their first dose. Some 52 million have also received a second dose, while nearly 10 million people have received a booster shot. At least 21 people have died after heavy snow trapped them in their cars in Pakistan's resort town of Muri. Pakistan's Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid says some 1,000 cars got stuck on a highway during a blizzard. The military is attempting to clear roads and rescue those still trapped near Muri. Authorities say over 100,000 vehicles were on the roads to see the unusually heavy snowfall, which created a massive traffic jam. Provincial officials have declared the town a disaster area, urging people to stay away. Heavy snow has been reported there for days, causing food and gas shortages. Prime Minister Imran Khan has called the situation a tragedy and ordered an investigation.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
U.S. Republican politicians and conservative media have been on a months-long campaign to whitewash the attack on the Capitol. We're prepared for you an article written by Nick Robbins early. The piece is titled, Inside the FBI's Capitol Riot Investigation. Will the attackers be held accountable? It has been 1 year since a mob of Donald Trump supporters stormed the United States Capitol as the Stop the Steal rally demanding to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election turned into a deadly insurrection. After the attack, the U.S. Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, FBI, mobilized one of the largest criminal investigations in American history. Those efforts have so far resulted in more than 700 federal cases and counting, with more suspects expected to be charged. But for all that, we have learned about the insurrection and the people who took part in it, crucial questions remain about the fallout of the attack for the far right and what it means to hold its perpetrators accountable. Experts say federal prosecutors want the arrests and convictions of those responsible to act as a deterrent against extremism and future attempts to undermine democracy. But despite more than 150 guilty pleas so far, the legacy of 6th of January is already contentious. A judicial debate has emerged over the appropriate sentencing for rioters, while trials in the coming months will test whether prosecutors can secure convictions on more serious charges facing far-right extremists. The fundamental understanding of what happened on 6th of January is also being increasingly contested, as Republican lawmakers and right-wing media attempt to whitewash the events and reframe the insurrection as an act of justified political protest. More than any court case, researchers say, this revisionist narrative may have long-lasting implications for the far right and for political violence in America. In the months after the insurrection, law enforcement officials investigated hours upon hours of videos from the day, thousands of social media profiles, and hundreds of thousands of tips from the public. They have arrested hundreds of people, sometimes raiding homes where suspects had stockpiled weapons and ammunition. As the arrests rolled in, researchers began to get a more complete picture of who was involved in the attack. The people charged came to Washington, D.C. from nearly every state in the Union and ranged from teenagers to senior citizens. Beyond sharing a fervent support for Donald Trump and belief in election conspiracies, no single profile has emerged. Overall, the suspects are overwhelmingly male, about 80%, according to research from George Washington University's Project on Extremism, and the average age is 39. The vast majority of suspects are white. Many belong to far-right militias and white nationalist groups that played an outsized role in the attack. There were white-collar workers, people who came with their family members, and a cross-section of other Trump supporters radicalized into committing political violence. Many believed in the QAnon conspiracy movement that viewed Donald Trump as a messianic figure who would return to office and destroy a cabal of liberal elite child abusers. There have been significant differences between how U.S. district court judges have approached sentencing in cases. One group of judges has questioned why prosecutors are seeking jail time for misdemeanor offenses such as trespassing on Capitol grounds. U.S. District Judge Trevor McFadden, a Donald Trump appointee, made comparisons between Black Lives Matter protesters and the 6th of January attackers and told the defendant that he was acting like all those looter and rioters last year. However, Judge McFadden did later reject the defendant's claim that he was being treated unfairly compared with leftist protesters in Portland, Oregon. Other judges have vehemently rejected the comparison to the Black Lives Matter movement and have insisted that participants in the riot face serious consequences for their involvement. U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan stated that the siege was an unprecedented attempt to violently overthrow the government of the United States and stop the peaceful transition of power. Chief U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell questioned why prosecutors were letting rioters accept lighter misdemeanor plea deals and lamented that the government has essentially tied the sentencing judges' hand out. Researchers say the more complex cases and serious charges will probably go to trial in the coming months, including those involving members of the Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, and other far-right militias. One member of the Oath Keepers, Jason Dolan, already admitted as part of a plea deal that he traveled with other militia members and stashed an M4 rifle at a Comfort Inn, a short drive outside of the capital. In December, 34-year-old Matthew Green became the first member of the Proud Boys to plead guilty in a felony conspiracy case, with prosecutors stating that he and other Proud Boys coordinated their actions using programmable radios and dressed to conceal their affiliation with the group. After the riot, Matthew Green ordered more than 2,000 rounds of assault rifle ammunition, bragged that his group took the capital, and told a friend to study guerrilla warfare and be ready to do uncomfortable things. The criminal trials this spring for felony charges such as obstructing Congress and a multi-defendant conspiracy case against members of the Oath Keepers may reveal new details about the level of coordination and planning that went into the attack on the Capitol on 6th of January. But they will probably also present difficulties for prosecutors. The government has already succeeded in dismissing some pre-trial defense objections, such as whether the common charge of corruptly obstructing an official proceeding was unconstitutionally vague, but more challenges will come. The FBI received more than 250,000 tips relating to the siege, including family members turning in relatives and Facebook friends reporting old high school acquaintances. One suspect, New York State's Robert Chapman, told a match on the dating app Bumble that he had stormed the Capitol and bragged about making it all the way to the National Statuary Hall. According to court filings, before sending a screenshot of their exchange to law enforcement, the other Bumble user replied, "We are not a match." More than 80% of cases cite some form of social media as evidence for the charges. But the FBI's investigation goes far beyond relying on amateur online sleuths and combing through social media profiles. Law enforcement has also used invasive technology and surveillance tactics that could expand law enforcement powers and have implications for future investigations. In addition to using facial recognition software to identify rioters, itself a deeply controversial practice, law enforcement appears to have expanded its use of geofencing search warrants, a process that involves using data from digital services to locate people within a certain area during a given time period. In practice, it means that authorities can demand Google hand over anonymized user location data, then ask for specific users' private information, including their names, emails, and phone numbers. According to a Wired investigation, dozens of Capitol rioters cases cite Google location data in their court filings. The FBI's use of surveillance has come under additional scrutiny in recent weeks after a New York Times investigation found that the Bureau deployed surveillance teams to monitor Portland activist protests against policing, a move that civil rights groups condemned as domestic spying. As the FBI has carried out its investigation, there has been a parallel effort to create a different narrative of the insurrection. Republican politicians and conservative media outlets have been on a month-long campaign to whitewash the attack on the Capitol. Over the past year, they have settled on a story that presents 6th of January as a largely peaceful protest for legitimate election grievances, sometimes baselessly claiming that any violence was the result of Antifa or leftist infiltrators. Primetime Fox News host Tucker Carlson in November aired a 3-episode special entitled Patriot Purge that uncritically interviewed right-wing activists with ties to the white nationalist movement who claimed that the FBI investigation is an unjust political crackdown on conservatives. Tucker Carlson states in it that there is a leftist purge aimed at legacy Americans and features sympathetic interviews with people who took part in the insurrection. Two Fox News contributors quit over the special, with one suggesting that it would lead to violence. Some Republican lawmakers have amplified this far-right narrative that the suspects being held in pretrial detention are political prisoners and unjustly suffering for their beliefs. Representatives, including Marjorie Taylor Greene, Paul Gosar, Matt Gaetz, and Louis Gohmert, have rallied in support of insurrection suspects and staged an attempt to visit the jail, claiming a conspiracy to mistreat the prisoners and that their detention was evidence of Marxism and totalitarianism. Even if the authorities may be better prepared against future rallies aimed at subverting the democratic process, the reaction from right-wing media and some Republican lawmakers has threatened to legitimize far-right ideology and resorting to political violence to achieve their goals.
Food for thought.
Salam, dear listeners. How about listening to thought-provoking words from the Prophet's 16th infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace upon him, regarding the lofty epithets in the divine court of his most noble ancestress, Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace upon her. Fatima has 9 names near Allah the Exalted. These are Siddiqah, or the most truthful, Mubarakah, or the blessed, Tahireh, or the spotlessly pure, Zakiyah, or the pristinely chaste, Raziyah, Al-Marziyah, or the one who is gratified and contented with God's will, Muhaddithah, or the lady to whom angels speak, and Zahra, or the most radiant.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Dear brothers and sisters, achieving perfection is the goal of life. It is the whole and sole objective of a religious man's life. Now, what is perfection? It's also a very important question. You know, I did mention in the previous episode that perfection is not achieved unless one gives room and space to reason. Allama Tabatabai says in his Islamic teachings in brief that a house is perfect when it provides for all the needs of a family's living, such as enough rooms to serve as a living room, a guest house, a kitchen for making food, a bathroom, and other rooms. If it lacks these utilities, it is proportionately deficient. The same is the case with man whose goal is to seek perfection, you know. Whole and sole objective of a person's life is to achieve perfection. Perfection in the case of a human being means that he should achieve those qualities which are good for his prosperity, which are instrumental in his felicity and in bringing him felicity, of course. Allama Tabatabai also says that the attribute of perfection is that which meets some of the needs of existence, obviates deficiency. For example, the epithet of knowledge obviates the darkness of ignorance and elucidates what is known to the scholar. Also, power enables a powerful person to attain his ends and satisfy his demands and makes him competent to do so. So this is what Allama Tabatabai says in his book, Islamic Teachings in Brief. It is obviously incumbent on anyone who wishes to achieve perfection to avoid extravagance on either side. He should not go to extremes. He should rid himself of the harmful inclinations. And these harmful inclinations, of course, stem from evil traits. He should change them into useful and beautiful feelings. Such feelings can only appear good if they are obedient to the command of reason. As long as reason dominates the human life, he is always following the right path. He is always moving in the right direction, because whatever the reason commands is in line with the religion, and whatever religion says is accepted by the reason. There is no contradiction and conflict between reason and religion. Human feelings are like a container that is divided in two sections, the first section being offensive and the other defensive. If man can direct his defensive feelings to become victorious over the offensive ones, then he will gain control of his existence and lead it as he desires, not as they desire. So this is also just an explanation of a psychologist. Let's have a break. We will be back.
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West. ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Those who have balanced their internal powers with their lusts and that which their dreams prefer, and have created a sense of peace between their minds and hearts, have undoubtedly followed the path of happiness between the problems of life, will free of weakness, free of failure or defeat. You know, there's no doubt as to the fact that man's abilities have reached a very advanced level of practicality, movement, and speed. And this has, of course, given mankind the chance to reach deep into the depths of seas and oceans using his thinking powers. What we observe today of the continuous misery and fluctuation in the heart of civilization, especially in the United States and America, and of course those countries that claim to be civilized, what we see today in terms of misery and fluctuation has reached the point that it has become like a toy in the hands of problems and inflictions. This can be largely due to the fact that man has diverted from the path of noble traits and spiritual values. When man diverts and deviates from the path of spiritual values, from the path of noble traits, then there's no doubt that he will suffer misery, and he will suffer inflictions beyond imagination. Science has advanced in this era. We have no doubt about it, that science is in its peak. But manners and feelings are still in their primitive stages. Manners have not advanced. Now, what happens if science advances but manners do not? Obviously, man in that case will always tend to misuse science, misuse this capacity. And there's no doubt that if manners and feelings had advanced along with reason and along with the human mind, then we could possibly state that mankind advanced in their humanity too. So unfortunately, that is not what we see on the ground. Manners have not advanced. Humanity is in reality degenerating. It is kind of going backward, despite the fact that science has advanced tremendously, and it has advanced beyond imagination, but manners have not advanced. And as I said, manners are still in their primitive stages. Let's also conclude that the civilization that lacks noble traits faces destruction and extinction, because that civilization will not persist, it will not continue, because there is no noble traits, there is no moral values, there is no moral support and spiritual support to keep it up. So it's doomed. A civilization that does not have noble traits, and a civilization that lacks noble traits, is doomed. In the absence of course, noble traits, nothing persists, nothing will hold. The reason for the persisting miseries, persisting imperfections in various societies, is a phenomenon of people's needs for moral values, is the phenomenon for people's needs for moral traits, for manners. It is the values that give life to the people, but also a civilization. It is the values that not only give life to humanity, but it also gives life to civilization. And it is those values that grant it the power that civilization righteously deserves. So civilizations, in fact, depend wholly and squarely on moral traits. Civilization will not continue to subsist and will not continue to stand on its feet unless there are noble traits and moral values, which guarantee it is continuity, it is survival, and it is existence. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he
news, social news, scientific news, artistic news, with delight.
Let's see what's happening in one of the world's oldest festivals. It's called Black and White Carnival, celebrated every year in the Colombian city of Pasto. But it has a lot more than what its name may suggest. The carnival, full of vibrant colors and fun, livens up when people perform music too. Those in attendance even threw talcum powder and foam to add more doses of joy. More things to visit too, colorful monuments and floats are brought to the streets. An artisan explains what's behind one of the huge sculptures exhibited there.
This commemorates what we are going through right now in the world, the virus, that little thing that brought COVID. We have skulls, people who died, those who are reborn, children, old people, and a lady. That's the whole motif. It's called rebirth.
The event has roots in Spanish and African traditions related to the indigenous people of Colombia. The carnival is aimed at highlighting the diversity of ethnic and cultural backgrounds. Its name symbolizes unity and equality. The festival continues until January the 10th. A zoo in the Netherlands is celebrating the birth of a newborn manatee, a rare event among the endangered species, especially within the confines of captivity. The newcomer was born in a Royal Burger Zoo in the Dutch city of Arnhem. Zookeepers say the birth went smoothly, adding that this is the mother's second calf. The newborn is still too young for keepers to be able to determine its gender, but handlers hope it will be a female. That's because there are only 15 females in European zoos. Manatees are closely related to elephants and are sometimes called sea cows because of their herbivorous diet. These gentle giants are listed as vulnerable to extinction, mainly because of loss of habitat and collisions with boats. Shanghai is one of the most famous cities in the world, boasting an impressive number of tourist attractions. Now, the city is host to a new event that could draw excited visitors. The exhibition includes more than 100 items from Egypt, including 6 golden mummies. The most prized object on display is a 20-year-old female mummy with a gold mask and 2 jewels for eyes. Organizers have also put up for show original works by great European artists such as Raphael and Pablo Picasso.
Chinese astronauts on board the space station have held a unique conference with students, sending them a message that sky is the limit. They hope to inspire students to pursue their dreams and be proactive about their goals. Let's have a listen.
Every one of us went through rigorous selection and arduous training before carrying out space missions. Many people have to wait for several years, dozens of years, and even a whole life. But what deserves praise is that we have never given up, but remained true to our original aspiration, stood the loneliness, and passed the tests.
Ye, who is a first-time space traveler, also encouraged students to be brave in following their dreams. The Chinese astronauts talked about their life, work, and personal experiences. Students from Beijing, Hong Kong, and Macau were given the rare chance to ask their own questions during the Ground Space Conference. China launched Shenzhou 13 into space in October last year. The astronauts are scheduled to stay in orbit for 6 months, which will be the country's longest ever crewed mission.
The mobile public library is back in the Afghan capital, Kabul, to bring joy to children with exciting books and games. The library reaches hundreds of children on a daily basis, seeking to expand its coverage in the coming days. Rahmatullah Baghban has more.
As the sun rises in Kabul, the Charmagh's mobile library starts a fresh mission to delight children. The library goes from zone to zone in the capital, Kabul, to spread the joy and love of reading among the Afghan children. It operates in 5 buses and has a children-friendly space. The organizers say they are happy being back for Afghan children.
That's why we want to enhance reading among children and boost their creative thinking. We have 5 mobile libraries operating across Kabul. Our services were shut for 3 months due to government change, but now they're happy that once again they can reach Kabul children. The library was sponsored by Afghan traders, but now it's out of funds and needs economic support.
I love my job here as a librarian. It's free for all. Children from different backgrounds come here to read books and play games. What I love most is watching children smiling and having fun with each other. I'm proud I can serve them with the skill I have.
Children are highly excited as they find the library right in front of their houses. Hundreds of children make daily use of initiative as most schools in Kabul lack library.
The mobile library used to come to our alley every week, but over the past 3 months, it didn't come, and we missed it so much. We are very happy that it is bringing us joy again. Nowadays that our schools are closed, we can make use of its books.
We thank Charmagh for its services. We have learned to read stories, play games, and draw pictures. We have kind teachers and have a good time with our friends.
This creative reading campaign starts as the country faced many challenges, affecting children's schooling and taking reading opportunities from them. As schools remain closed for most Afghan children, such services can be a good haven for students and book lovers. The initiative can also encourage children and bring the reading to life. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
People in the northeastern Chinese province are trying to keep alive a winter tradition going back centuries. Each year, local fishermen and women in Jilin use an ancient technique to catch fish from Chagan Lake that is sealed with a thick layer of ice. What these locals do is they drill holes through the ice and put their nets under the holes to catch fish. But to pull out those nets from the lake, they will need help from a bunch of horses.
It was my first time seeing such a scene. 5 horses drawing a turntable to gradually pull the net up to the ice surface. I felt very novel to witness this.
The technique has been listed as a cultural heritage in China. The ceremony attracts a large number of local tourists during the fishing season, which lasts until the end of February.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Albino animals are rare and very vulnerable, so when you find one, you need to make sure they get all the care they need to survive. And now Colombian vets are doing all they can to help the very first case of an albino baby, Jaguarundi, that's been rescued there. Fire department volunteers rescued this female cub in the urban areas of the Abora Valley region. The vets are now giving it primary medical attention. The baby Jaguarundi will then be transferred to a conservation park in the city of Medellin for more protection. A local expert explains why they cannot put back the animal into the wild.
At this point, this animal cannot be released to the wild due to its albino condition. It is predisposed to certain health disorders, certain disadvantages when performing in the wild. Therefore, the only alternative for it is to end his life in a park such as this.
Albino animals face many difficulties in the wild and struggle with basic survival skills. They do not have good eyesight, and due to their lack of pigmentation, they cannot camouflage. Therefore, just like endangered species, human monitoring would increase their chances of survival.
Swimming in sub-zero temperatures can be unimaginable for most people, but not for a group of athletes who've tested their skills and strength in Prague's Vltava River. 360 people from 8 countries gathered in the Czech capital to participate in an annual winter swimming event. The air temperature was minus 6 degrees Celsius, with water temperatures dipping to as low as 3 degrees. The event honors Alfred Nikodem, a Czech swimmer who braved the frigid waters in Prague for the first time in 1923, starting a tradition that has been kept alive ever since. Now the world's most powerful observatory is finally on its million-kilometer journey after several technical delays. The NASA telescope named James Webb blasted off into orbit on Saturday, heading to an outpost that's 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. The observatory was in the making for some 3 decades and cost about $10 billion. It left Earth enclosed in a rocket and from a launch pad in South America. The journey will last a month. The telescope is the size of a tennis court. And if everything goes according to plan, it will enter service in June. Astronomers are hoping they can learn more about the origins of the universe once it starts beaming back new clues. The school in Spain is offering students an opportunity to join a special orchestra. The project dubbed The Music of Recycling brings unwanted junk back to life by transforming them into musical instruments. And here is how they sound. The project offers the instruments to the orchestra in one of Madrid's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. The students say the orchestra keeps them away from mischief and out of serious trouble while giving them an artistic outlet. Several dozens of children are taking music classes from members of the orchestra as part of the project. The ensemble has put on several concerts across Spain, but because of the pandemic, they had to pause their performances. The project is run by a Spanish environmental group and is inspired by a similar orchestra in Paraguay.